Welcome to Pet Food Advisors. I'm Tracy Hotchner, here with my co-host, Dr. Sean Delaney, a leading voice in veterinary nutrition, who co-wrote the only independent textbook on animal nutrition and co-founded Balance It to help vets and owners customize their pets' diets. Call us with any questions you have about what you're feeding your cats and dogs. Our number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. We'd like to thank our sponsors, Waruva Pet Food, Precious Cat Litter, The Honest Kitchen, Nordic Naturals Omega-3 Fish Oil, Halo Purely for Pets, Vaxacheck, Platinum Performance, Feel Away for Cats and Adaptil for Dogs, Vectra and Vector 3D. And Whole Life Pet will send you a free sample box of freeze-dried protein treats for cats and dogs if you send me your mailing address to radiopetlady@gmail.com. We want you to know we've invited this show's sponsors because they're companies we believe in and use ourselves. Please show your appreciation for their support by becoming a customer yourself. There's also a whole week's worth of wonderful live pet shows I co-host on our own Radio Pet Lady Network. Tonight, it's a Dog's Life with Greg Kleva at 8 p.m. East, 5 West. Go to RadioPetLady.com to see the schedule and to listen. This show is a production of 8 Paws LLC and DVM Consulting, Inc., which are solely responsible for its content. That number again is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. We'd love to hear from you. Dr. Sean Delaney, this is so fun. We're embarking on such an amazing voyage here. I feel very privileged to have someone of your great talent, deep knowledge, and complete commitment to information and correctness about nutrition and pets to be sharing this amazing platform with me so that we can explain things to people a little better than how they've understood them so far. It's great to have you here.
Tracy, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm really looking forward to talking about something that's a passion for me, and it's a very kind introduction you give to me, and hopefully over the course of our talks we'll help folks to do a little bit better job of giving their pets things that they enjoy but also are helpful.
Yes, and also to feel comfortable when they're having a knee-jerk reaction. Oh, I would never do that, or I always need to do that, whether it's, you know, dry food cleans teeth. We know that is pretty much of a bogus claim. But people that are afraid to give people food, and what's all that about? So there's so many things that people are afraid to do and feel compelled to do. And there's also the dreaded internet, which one can love because it lets, you know, Pet Food Advisors and the whole Radio Pet Lady Network exist, but it's also full of some crazy people. Wouldn't you say around pet food, you got some real wackadoos?
I don't know that I would call it that. I'd say they're passionate. And I often will always say that, unfortunately, passion is not always a substitute for knowledge.
or common sense.
You can say that. I think that, you know, you allude to it, something very interesting, that nutrition is one of those things that is not just something we think about rationally. We have emotional response to it. And so sometimes emotion gets into it, and I understand that. I'm very passionate about things as well, so maybe I fall into the crazy category occasionally. But hopefully we can have a conversation based on fact and what we know and give a balanced view. And I often find that nothing is black and white. Certainly things are gray areas, and hopefully we'll explore that fully when we talk to each other and talk to other folks that may call in the future or today.
I think that is so well said. In fact, those of you that have listened to me and followed me for years will think, really? Things aren't black and white? Tracy's the black and white person. So one of the reasons that I doubly appreciate you, Sean, is that you have that kindness and that encompassing idea that everyone has come to their beliefs and what they hold to from a good place, from loving their pets and wanting to do the right thing. And the gray area is both that we have to give everyone some wiggle room, both in the choices they make about their own dinner and that for their pets, and also to understand that there are some cold and hard facts which are often missing from both professional advice or commercial advice and from personal decisions, which are often driven by sometimes passion gone like tipped right over the edge. And that can happen because someone lost a pet in a pet food recall, or think that their animal got cancer from a food, and so they're kind of bending over backwards in the opposite direction. And somehow the pendulum needs to find its middle, right?
Absolutely. And ultimately, you have to feel comfortable with what you're feeding. It's one of the few things that we do for our pets on a daily basis that affects their health. And so I understand why people are so passionate. It's wonderful as a nutritionist. You know, I think it would be far worse if folks didn't care about what we do and didn't care so much. And I'm fortunate to work with folks and talk to folks on a daily basis that care very deeply, very passionately about what they're feeding their animals. And it's wonderful for me, who spent basically my entire career thinking about nutrition myself. So let's hopefully this other folks will find it useful, and we can have a great conversation about options and maybe some things that can help folks.
That's really well put, because while one can say, man, this person's like really getting to exercise, their blood pressure is rising on the topic of whether they should throw raw bones on the floor or whether everything in a bag is the same and that's all their dog should eat. It is better than someone who says dog food is just what's in the bag at Tractor Supply right next to the chicken food and the horse food. So what are you talking about? So you're right. It is wonderful to have people questioning authority, questioning assumptions, trying things out. As long as they then – I think Pet Food Advisors is going to help them every single week to get a little more information and then advice about choices they're making so they can customize. Because I think really it's the individualization of what you feed that's important. And I think that's something that somehow the commercial pet food industry and the veterinary profession/industry together kind of have narrowed that road down for people so that people don't feel that they have the freedom to kind of exercise a little creativity. Wouldn't you say that a lot of maybe vets coming out of vet school, I don't know which generation we're talking about exactly, but at some point they were told, you got to tell your clients to eat this food in this bag, only this food in this bag, and that's going to give consistency, and that's going to give health throughout the life of the pet. And I think some people have rebelled against that kind of straitjacket. Have you found when you have vets and owners come to you at Balance It, or when you were working at UC Davis for 10 years, you were a professor there in nutrition, did you find that there was some kind of blowback from people saying, that's too rigid, that doesn't seem logical?
I think that there's always a concern when you limit people's choices, and it's in a way that they're not informed about why those choices are being limited. I think that vets are trying oftentimes to give them kind of GPS coordinates, right? And so that may seem, that might seem restrictive, that this is the path, but maybe there's a reason they want you to go on the highway and not go in the opposite flow of a one-way road. But at other times, there may be a lot more flexibility. Maybe taking the scenic and a little bit longer road is something you choose to do, and getting there as fast and as most convenient and as quickly as possible isn't what you want to do. And so therefore, having that discussion about what paths can we get to the right answer is something that maybe just gets glossed over, because a lot of folks do want the most convenient, fastest route, if you will, to it. And sometimes other people say, hey, I want to go a little bit circuitous. I want to go off-way and discover some other options. And so I would analogize that I think that as a society, we are becoming more open-minded about nutrition. We are learning more all the time. Mm-hmm. And so as – I won't say it's generational, but just what we know about from 50 years ago versus today is very different about pet nutrition. And so maybe some things that were dogma a while back maybe aren't as hard fast as we've learned more, and exploring that. There's certainly still some rules of the road. We can't just, completely let the wheels fall off the car, using this analogy, bit further.
Yeah.
We have to consider that, there are some hard, fast rules that if you don't follow them going through the red light, you might get into an accident. So hopefully we'll understand the difference between the scenic route and the fastest route and following the rules of the road, and where you can drive your car safely and still kind of get to the same destination.
So it's sort of like if anyone's ever taken a road trip in Europe, of course people take road trips in America too, but in Europe it's more dramatic. You can either take the Superstrada, the Autostrada, the Autobahn, or you take the scenic route through little villages and you stop at a cafe and you see people's laundry hanging up. It takes you forever to get there. Maybe even you get lost, but you have this really great adventure. And if you're on the straightaway, you're going 95 miles an hour. You just go between point A and B. You got there. You're in one piece. You got there quickly. So I love that analogy, because I do think there are different personalities, and those of us that want to take the scenic route with food We want to do it responsibly, but we want to have fruits and vegetables and different proteins. And what about scrambled eggs? And how do you feel about yogurt? If we're those people, I think you're absolutely right. Who are we to say that the person just picking a good quality bagged food is really making a horrible error? Not really, because that's their choice of lifestyle, right?
That's absolutely right. And if they're picking something that's good enough quality that meets the needs of the animal, and the animal's, for all intents and purposes, as much as we can tell, thriving on it, mm-hmm. I'm not one to suggest that their approach is wrong without any basis for that, simply because maybe my approach might be a little bit different than theirs. If they're doing well in it and the animal's thriving, let's not mess with success.
Yeah, especially if you have an animal with a funny tummy, which you've got the German Shepherds, you have some of these breeds that just have such delicate stomachs. You change one thing and they're squirting out both ends. So for those people in particular, they're scared to correctly so, to change anything. You know, it's funny when you say that, is the dog thriving or the cat thriving? Are they doing well? Just today, there's a video up on the Humane Society of the United States website of yet another, this time not a puppy mill raid, but a hoarding raid. 100 animals, dogs, cats, goats, chickens, horses, emaciated fur, filthy, feces-encrusted, matted fur on every one of those species, and bones underneath all of it. And you think, you know, we're getting here so, you know, fine tooth comb, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? Is yogurt really okay every day? Does it have enough probiotics? And here you have animals that, you know, just a couple of bowls of kibble a day would have really made a great life for them.
That's exactly right. I went to an interesting talk at the university, because I still live in Davis, and they had a distinguished speaker from the University of Illinois, Dr. Honig, who's done a lot of work in cat diabetes, and that's obviously a very controversial area, a lot of a debate about what's the best approach. But what was fascinating, she opened with, and she was giving the talk in a series that's given annually after one of my mentors, Jim Morris, the Morris Lectureship, they ask an annual speaker. And he, you know, was one of the founders of feline nutrition. But what was really interesting, she popped up the slide. She was doing a study, and she was really fine-tuning, okay, is carbs important? Is protein important? You know, dry, wet, all this stuff. And as she was collecting the data and looking at the different feeding strategies that people utilize for their diabetic or even pre-diabetic cats, it was very interesting is that many of these diabetic and obese cats were being fed ad libitum, which is a fancy word for being fed as much food as they want, and there was no portion control. So in the midst of us, you know, thinking about, oh, how important is this component and this proportion of these nutrients, and she's doing all this detailed work, they're missing the point that an obese cat, maybe just giving it as much food as it possibly wants to eat isn't a really good strategy. They're missing the idea in a diabetic that feeding it ad lib when you're giving insulin only a couple times a day in the morning and evening, that isn't the right thing. So a very base strategy. It was a reminder to all of us in the audience as nutritionists and veterinarians how important just getting the foundation right is, and sometimes missing that and focusing on these, as you put, fine tooth issues really misses the point. And, you know, not even getting into the horrible sadness of hearing about, you know, puppy mill, as you brought up, which just makes me, you know, feel horrible. But just, you know, even folks that care about their animals and are doing the best they can, sometimes we can just start at the very basic and basic knowledge. You know, I think we hope at some point during this conversation to talk about protein. It's not a really exciting, glamorous topic, but boy, is there a lot of depth and things you can talk about it.
Well, it's very important to me because I've been Ms. Protein. Shove the protein. Protein is going to keep all of us slim, trim, and powerful. But we cannot go forward without me bringing up some questions, because those of my followers that know that I created the phrase kitty crack as the name for all dry food for all cats as being an inappropriate comestible for an obligate carnivore, and having a lot of diabetes cat organizations, Feline Outreach and Your Diabetic Cat, as sort of backers of my platform, if you will, or vice versa. We all kind of learn something from each other, and Dr. Lisa Pearson and some other great vets, Dr. Elizabeth Hodgkins, who's been, I would say, one of my mentors in how my ideas have developed and how cats should eat. I need to talk to you as a nutritionist, and what's important to me first before I ask these questions is that people understand that I have in the past been disparaging about the content of what is taught to vets in vet school vis-a-vis nutrition for two reasons. It's extremely limited. But then again, in human medical school, it's even more limited. I don't think there's any nutrition course that's even required. And everyone's seen you know, human doctors not necessarily have great diets or healthy lifestyles themselves. And we don't ask our human doctors what to eat for lunch or even what to feed our children for dinner, even if they're pediatricians. We just don't. Whereas with vets, we do. But those books, except for one very special book, which I now own, called Applied Veterinary Clinical Nutrition. Not the snappiest title in the whole world. You don't see it on the New York Times bestseller list. This is a book co-authored by our very own Dr. Sean. And it is the only book. It's Wiley Blackwell, which is one of the most renowned and respected textbook companies, at least in America, maybe the world. This is the only textbook that is not underwritten by a commercial pet food company. Now, those of you who've listened for years know that I have had a gripe about that because it seemed to me conflict of interest. I also did point out that the very first one of these vet, maybe not the absolutely first, the early versions of the textbook, almost all of them originally were underwritten by Hill's before it was called ScienceSide, which is called Hill's Nutrition. And ironically, a dear friend who's a veterinary acupuncturist and chiropractor, used to be a primary care physician and is no longer, she loaned me her copy because of the issue of what cleans pets' teeth, particularly dogs, and the idea that dry food actually makes their teeth have more tartar and plaque is pretty much factual and common sense. And she said that this great he's still at the University of Pennsylvania, but at the time he was a great teacher of veterinary dental work, Jan Bellows. And he used to bellow, apparently, in I guess it was an auditorium, not a classroom. They're big classes, right, at UC Davis also. And he would say, the only way to clean the dog's teeth is the bull penis. And he was all about using what are now called, you know, flossies and these various things to really get the dog to grind on something that was safe and would clean the teeth. And the Hill's book that she loaned me, that had this issue in there as well and didn't say that dry food would clean their teeth because it was before the commercial industry in general grew up, the back of the book was full of homemade recipes, probably like some of the ones that at your company Balance It. Some version of those is what you recommend to people with, especially with pets with illnesses or compromises. So certainly things have changed over time. But I don't know Dr. Honig's work, and I'm sure she is a marvelous researcher and doctor, but I'm a little surprised that a couple of things. One is that I guess if you're a researcher, you have to study dry food with X recipe for a diabetic cat versus wet food. But to me, it's a little like those cancer trials where when they find out that one drug really works to cure cancer or one really doesn't work, they stop the trial because they're putting people at risk. Seems to me that at least from all the research I've done, which doesn't hold a candle to what you've done, or maybe even what Dr. Honig's has done, dry food is the cause of pre-diabetic conditions in cats. And if you take away dry food from a pre-diabetic or a recently insulin-dependent cat and put them on an all-wet diet, they aren't insulin-dependent anymore. Their diabetes reverses. They are no longer a diabetic cat. Now, that is factual. I mean, that's just not someone's wishful thinking. But how does that fit in the story of let's try some dry, let's try some wet? And I also have understood, again, through a lot of feline practitioners, that cats that get hooked on dry food, there's a carb addiction on a cellular level. I mean, there's a whole kind of story about that that in another show I'd love to discuss with you. That if you feed wet food to cats, if you start them on it, they'll never gorge. They're not like humans and Labrador retrievers that will just eat till they burst. They eat as much as they need until they're satisfied, and they'll do that a couple of times a day, and they may even leave a little behind. Whereas with dry food, the grazing, which is inappropriate to an obligate carnivore hunter, becomes a habit, both, I guess, psychological, emotional, and physical. So they are eating all the time, but it's because it's an inappropriate diet. Now, I know I've thrown a lot out there, but I have to bring that up before we talk about the marvels of protein, which is truly of great fascination to me and to everyone else who's always saying, this food's great because it's high protein. Now, you were the man who researched and developed, probably that I know of, the first and probably the greatest high protein kibble, which was Evo. Very famous amongst animal foodies. It's like that was the gold standard to manage to make a food that high protein, that high quality, and therefore that valuable or costly. So I know you must love protein too.
Well, you've given about three shows worth of things to respond to.
Okay, so you pick. Take your pick. Actually, I'll tell you what. We're going to go to a break, and I'm sorry that I went on like that. I should have broken it up into bits. If you can't remember the first thing I said, I'll roll it back in my own mind. We're going to pop off for a break, and you can take a deep breath and think, what have I gotten myself into? We will be right back. This show is supported by Platinum Performance Canine Wellness Formula, which is a comprehensive nutritional foundation formula for all dogs, which addresses canine health at the cellular level, providing a special blend of more than 55 nutrients that improves the fundamental health of each of your dog's 12 trillion cells. Healthy cells mean a healthy dog. That's the Platinum difference. Platinum Performance Canine Wellness is a supplement scientifically proven to improve the cognitive ability of dogs in a study designed to measure their learning ability. When the dogs were tested on how well they remembered the skills learned in the first phase, dogs on Platinum Performance demonstrated superior memory by completing the task more quickly than the control group. To give your dog that mental edge, especially as she ages, go to RadioPetLady.com to get free samples and learn more. And there's Platinum Feline Formula for the kitties, too. Support for the show comes from Waruva, a family-owned company that makes canned food for cats and little dogs from ingredients we could eat ourselves. Because they think dogs and cats should eat as well as we do, so their foods are made in a human food facility. We salute Waruva's ethical decision to make no dry food because they know that for optimal wellness, small dogs don't need highly processed carbohydrates, and that true health for cats, who are obligate carnivores, means they should eat only meat and have no need for carbohydrates in their diet. In addition to all the delicious Waruva recipes, they also make Cats in the Kitchen in pouches and their more economical BFF, Best Feline Friend brand, using smaller-bodied fish for your cat's health. This show is brought to you by Vectra 3D for Dogs, a safe and effective topical anti-tick and flea treatment that you put on your dog's skin once a month to repel parasites. Vectra 3D has the newest technology. In scientific tests, Vectra 3D was shown to create a shield on your dog's skin to repel ticks and kill them fast and reliably for the entire month, unlike older products which don't last the full 30 days and only kill ticks that bite your dog, a bite which can actually transmit the many tick-borne diseases even without the parasites staying attached. With Vectra 3D, ticks are killed just by coming into contact with your dog, but it's still safe for the people in your family. Vectra for cats and dogs who live where there are no ticks is the anti-flea topical treatment that repels and kills fleas and also kills all three life cycles of the flea. Vectra is only available from practicing veterinarians. To learn more and find out how your own vet can get the Vectra products, go to RadioPetLady.com. We are back, Dr. Sean Delaney and myself, pet food advisors, and we're sort of, as our first show, getting the measure of each other and getting a sense of what our philosophies are, how we came to them, what our influences are in coming to conclusions, and I think both of us are pretty open-minded to at least respond to what the other person believes, thinks, has come to the conclusion of, or referencing other people's opinions, because I do reference other people's opinions if they're people who I think are really smart. Now, they don't have your degree, Sean. They don't have a veterinary nutrition degree, but some of them are pretty steeped in it. Like Dr. Elizabeth, like yourself, having been in Natura for years, you were in product development. She was at Hills and also at Purina. In one case, in Purina, actually in product development for a canned diabetic cat food that never did happen, I don't think. But as far as I'm concerned, from here forward, you're my guru. So what you tell me and explain to me, I'm going to believe, and that's the story I'm going to tell forward. So if anybody thinks that I'm flip-flopping, if I flip-flop, it's because Sean talked me into it, and I'm grateful for it.
Well, I don't know that I'll convince you of anything, but I'm certainly happy to kind of go over some things. And I'm very open-minded about things. I have learned over time that we don't know everything. New knowledge becomes available. And the best way to look like a fool is to not be open-minded.
Well said. Well said.
So I guess I'll start, and I'm, you know, obviously I'm very passionate about the cat food discussion, and we'll talk about that. But I want to take a step back before the break and just talk about veterinarians and their training, because I think you brought that up first.
Yes.
And I think it gives us a good basis.
Good point.
I think I'll counter, you know, my training and maybe how it's a little bit different than other veterinarians. I will start off by saying, since you brought it up, I don't think that just by having board certification in the field, you're the only one that knows anything. And I think there are a lot of great animal scientists that have dedicated their careers and lives to knowing more about cat and dog nutrition, and they contribute very important new knowledge to animal nutrition, and to discount many animal nutritionists' efforts just because they're not board certified veterinary nutritionists would be a disservice and unkind and really unfair. So what I think we'll start with is, let's just talk about veterinarians and their training. Much like I think you alluded to, I don't know a lot about medical school, but my impression of medical school for humans is they have a lot of stuff they need to cover in a very compressed amount of time. And specialization is how they address maybe, you know, areas where they don't have as much knowledge in a particular area. And so that's why, you know, there's residencies for human medicine. And we don't have that as much, or is not as common for veterinarians, but even in the veterinary curriculum at most schools, there is some degree of veterinary nutrition. Now, that may be widely variable. So I'll use my best knowledge, which is in, you know, UC Davis, which has a very strong history of nutrition. And it has a basic nutrition course, and that's usually a pretty common, curricula in commonality, where you will find that many schools have some basic nutrition course, and it'll cover not just small animal nutrition, but usually, you know, ruminant or herbivore nutrition, you know, horse nutrition, all in one fell swoop. And that's a lot to cover. Right. And so they may have that, but there's really not going to be the same depth. Unfortunately, at some schools, they don't have a nutrition at all on the faculty. And so who may be training that can be variable. Some of that you will hear folks that have a anti-commercially prepared pet food bias, I'll call it that, will say, you know, Hill's trains all the veterinarians. And there certainly is a role that Hill's has played in the training of veterinarians in nutrition. There's a very wisely the Hill's Corporation, when they signed an agreement with the Mark Morris, so that's different than the Jim Morris I brought up earlier, but Mark Morris, when he developed the first foods for Hill's, he, you know, signed an agreement with, you know, a canning facility, and a portion of that went to ultimately became the Mark Morris Institute, and there's also a foundation as well for animal research. But the MMI, which is called that, will go out and will do training at vet schools, and they do it even at Davis. Sometimes it's as limited as, you know, a day of a lab. Sometimes it's a series of courses. A lot of that is based on folks that, you know, have had a strong training in nutrition from Hill's. And so it's not surprising that Hill's philosophy stands out. I think the folks that are involved with it try to be as, you know, open and unbiased as they can be, but they also often are very involved in the research that has been done by Hill's that supports their foods. And so it's not surprising they believe in what they believe.
Right.
And so that at times, I think, you know, makes folks feel like, oh, it's just the pet food company coming in and training the veterinarians to sell Hill's foods. I would not say my experience is that's the case. I would say that their approaches to nutrition are trained and are discussed, and so that obviously flavors how veterinarians see things, and they have supported over the years a lot of research, and so they have, you know, supported what they say with scientific research. It isn't always right. We don't always get a scientist nutrition right. One study does not prove that that's the way things work, and so they can be wrong, and just like I can be wrong about anything I may say now or in the future. But what I think it does is, unfortunately, that coupled with the heavy marketing the Hill's does, because they do have prescription foods, and we can talk about those, it does give people a slant to think, oh, well, veterinarians only get their training from a pet food company. But often when there is a faculty member who is trained in nutrition, they have other courses. They may have, for example, at Davis, they have a advanced clinical nutrition course, which I helped instruct for a number of years. And that's given to juniors, where it's just focused on small nutrition. When I was a student, I sat in on a ruminant nutrition course because I was already interested in nutrition at the time. They have equine nutrition coursework, so they get more specialized. And then at Davis and at other institutions where there's a strong training program of specialists in nutrition, there's often a senior rotation where they can see clinical cases. So there can be quite a bit of nutrition education by some veterinarians, and that's grown over time. Certainly more offerings, even in the course of my career, than there were before. But I think painting with a broad brush that all veterinarians have little or no nutrition training is probably unfair. Saying that all veterinarians have a lot of training in nutrition is also probably equally untrue. And so I think there's variability, and it depends on where they trained and what they've spent their time in looking into. And I've had what we call in California, we have a great co-effort with the local state Veterinary Medical Association, CVMA, the Donlow Fellowship. And so there's veterinarians who have a strong interest in a particular field, and they come back into the university setting for 20 days over the course of a year. And the CVMA Donlow Fellowship that's coupled with the UC Davis, they'll come in and learn more about ultrasound or about medicine, or in case of folks I've had come through, about nutrition. And so some veterinarians have may gone on to have a lot of continuing education, even without board certification, because they have a passion or interest in there. So I think what you'll find is that there are some veterinarians that don't have a lot of strength in nutrition, just like I have very little strength maybe in neurology. And others will have a great deal of strength. And my experience with most veterinarians is they're very readily will admit to that. And they'll say, hey, this is not my strong suit, and let's go and get some additional help in this area, just like they would refer you maybe for a surgery. They might refer you for, an internal medicine for a more complex case. So I think that there's a lot going on. I think a lot of times whenever we paint with broad strokes, we, potentially maybe misinforming folks. But I do think that there's always room for us to learn more. And there's a lot for veterinarians. There's a lot for me to learn. I learn new things every day. And so I just wanted to clarify that maybe give a perspective on it. For me in my training, in addition to just being, the kind of person that, had an interest through vet school and sitting in extra courses and doing those, more advanced coursework when I could, I did a master's concurrently with my vet degree in nutrition. And so I took graduate courses in nutrition with people who are doing PhDs and a lot of human nutritionists. A lot of people are going to go on and be dietitians, which is very interesting to see that. And, most of my professors in that arena were human nutritionists and studied human nutrition. I did my master's thesis in, amino acid requirements in puppies and looking at protein requirements. But, there was a strong interest for me in that. And so I had that graduate work. At the time, folks that were board certified or wanted to be board certified had to have a graduate degree, so a master's or a PhD in nutrition. And then they would go off and do a residency, so typically anywhere from 2 or 3 years in nutrition. And then they would go and they'd have to do a couple of papers where they're the first authors in nutrition in a peer-reviewed journal and get published.
Wow.
The curriculum has changed a little bit where you only have one paper, that you have to do. You don't have to have a graduate degree, but still it's a rigorous anywhere from 2 to 3 year residency after you're already a veterinarian, after doing an internship.
Wow.
I did an internship in medicine and surgery with a great guy, Tim Bowers, who had done a residency in nutrition. So I got a little window into that already. And I had my master's, of course, in nutrition. So there's a lot of variability in what you're going to get with folks. I think the commonality is if the best folks will be the ones that say, I don't know. And I have found that the hardest thing as supposedly an expert is to say, I don't know. And it's something that when I've trained residents, and I've trained 6 or 7 boarded nutritionists over my career now, which doesn't sound like a lot until you realize there's less than 100 of us in the world. So at one point I increased the college by about 10% personally, but with some help with a colleague. But anyway, I think what you realize is that it's really hard for residents initially and people training to say, I don't know. But that's, if you can say that, that's the start of real knowledge and real learning and real wisdom, because that's where you then start asking questions and going, what do we really know? What do we believe, which is different than really knowing? And where are we not sure? And so you alluded to the textbook. I'm very, very fortunate to have had a great co-editor, Dr. Andrea Fassetti. She was a mentor of mine. I was her first full-time resident. I actually was the first full-time clinical nutrition resident in the country at the time, and she did a great job of helping train me, and we've worked with together for many years subsequently. And we did put this book together that you alluded to because we did want to have a textbook that wasn't seen as biased. I'm not saying that the textbooks that exist, you alluded to the small animal clinical nutrition, there's a lot of good nutritionists involved in it, but it is supported by that same MMI and Hills. And so, you have to take that with a grain of salt, and it does serve its purpose. But we really wanted to get a group of world experts. There's 20 different contributors in that textbook. I'm not trying to put a plug in for the textbook, but give a perspective of it. And we have, you know, people from different competing pet food companies that were recognized as experts. We have people from academia, and just a wonderful contribution. It took 6 years to put together. But what I do think it provides is a very rich and hopefully balanced approach of what do we know, what don't we know. And it's really written for the veterinarian audience, but I think you with an interest in it, it's a great resource. And if we don't know something, we don't have a reference for it, it's very clear that there is no reference for it. Of course, I'm very Western trained, which means that, you know, I'm not a holistic or an Eastern practitioner, which, you know, right. Some people say that that's, and they're not going to use a scientific approach from a Western perspective to prove their theories. And I have a lot of respect for folks that practice that way. It's just not my approach and right. not my training. And what that means is that if I'm going to say something, whether on this show or other, I'm going to say, I'm not sure, I don't know. Right. And, or this is what we do know. It may be right, it may not be right, but this is what we've found in the past. And so when I reference, for example, Dr. Honig, you know, she wasn't suggesting that dry food was superior regardless of where her support had come from. She was just looking at what people choose to do. And that's so my right. comment was, here's people that choose to do, and some are feeding, you know, canned, some right. are feeding dry. And then, but oh, by the way, I'm worried about all these details, but I have no idea how much calories are going into the animal, the very basic of, you know, the very first thing you want to know about decisions. And so that's really the core of what I'm going to get to. We've got probably to take another break, I think.
We'll take a break now.
But I've talked a lot.
But no, I love how you talk, and you're extremely well-spoken and articulate, and all the points you make are great. I've often said to people that if you have a human doctor or a vet who is able and willing to say at any point, I'm sorry, I really don't know, that's someone to embrace, because that's someone who – is open-minded, and if they don't know, they're going to go to everyone they ever met to try and find out, which is another great thing. All right, we're going to a break. When we come back, more on – clearly we're not getting to protein today, not like nail on the head, but boy, we've got weeks ahead of us, and I am just loving this to pieces. We will be right back. Support for this show comes from The Honest Kitchen, a family-owned company that makes raw dehydrated pet foods from 100% human-grade ingredients, from food ingredients that are gently dehydrated to remove only the moisture yet retain most of the natural nutrients. Everyone knows that the least processed foods are the most nutritious, and Lucy at The Honest Kitchen developed her unique foods based on this principle. The Honest Kitchen's all-natural, clean, safe products can assist cats and dogs with chronic health problems like itchy skin, ear infections, and GI upset, which are often linked to a poor quality or inappropriate diet. Just add water to the dry mix to create a fresh, warm, healthy meal for your cat or dog. Go to RadioPetLady.com for information about calling The Honest Kitchen for a complimentary consultation to find out which recipe is right for your pet and get free samples. This show is supported by the pheromone products Feel Away for cats and Adaptil for dogs. Pheromones are chemical communicators that replicate a signal of comfort in your pet's brain. And veterinary nutritionists often recommend Feel Away and Adaptil to help patients with behavior issues as a stress reliever that can help solve many common behavior challenges or even emotional discomfort you may not recognize. Feel Away for cats and Adaptil for dogs can also be comforting for newly adopted cats and dogs from stressful backgrounds, and especially for new puppies and kittens experiencing the fear and loneliness of leaving their litters. Feel Away diffusers and spray for cats help with feline behavior issues in a multi-cat household for out-of-litter box issues and to get a cat used to her carrier for travel or vet visits. Adaptil for dogs helps alleviate anxiety and stress-related symptoms whether your dog is at home, in a car, or out in the world. Adaptil comes in a diffuser, spray, and the most effective way, a collar. Veterinary animal behaviorists often recommend Feel Away and Adaptil to help patients with behavior issues. You can find the pheromone products through the link at RadioPetLady.com, where there's a discount to Dr. Sean's online store, PetCareNaturally.com. VaxaCheck wants to know, are you worried about the harmful side effects of over-vaccinating your dog? But is your vet worried whether your dog still has protection from previous vaccinations? VaxaCheck takes the worry out of keeping your dog safe. Avoid the risks of automatically revaccinating by asking for VaxaCheck, a blood titer test done right in your veterinarian's office while you wait. It shows whether your dog has immunity to the deadly core diseases, distemper, parvovirus, and hepatitis. If she has the antibodies in her blood, you don't need to revaccinate. But if she doesn't have protective immunity to one of the diseases, then you revaccinate only against that one illness. VaxaCheck should be used on every puppy to confirm that she actually got the protective antibodies from her puppy shots, which are not guaranteed to be 100% effective. Shelters and rescues should use VaxaCheck on new arrivals to separate healthy dogs from unprotected ones. For your dog's safety and your peace of mind, ask for a VaxaCheck test at your dog's yearly checkup so you and your vet make the best decision about long-term health. VaxaCheck for cats is coming soon. I am back with Dr. Sean, the miraculous veterinary nutritionist who is setting me straight, all of us straight, but doing it with such a gentle hand, we barely see it happening. Sean, just the topic of cats overeating and certainly calories and portion control and all that, we know with our dogs, who will many of them eat until they blow up like a balloon, is something that I get sloppy with. A little more than a cup, a little more than half a cup. Add a little of this, no big deal. And little by little, they add a pound here and a pound there. My understanding was that cats will not eat to excess. They will eat to satisfy themselves, that when they feel full, that they're full and they stop. Now, I personally am, as a human, and I know all humans are so different in appetite and weight and stuff, I can't eat past being full. When I'm full, I stop. I understand there are people with eating disorders that eat themselves silly. But with cats, is there not something about the species, you who have spent your life studying, you know, the recipes and the ingredients and the health benefits of those things, is that not something that's generally known or believed?
So, you know, I think we go back to what we believe is the evolution of dogs and cats. And, you know, we believe that the dog has come from the wolf. There's a lot of now upcoming data to support that from the genetics. Really, the dog is a subspecies of the wolf. And there's some really recent work coming out that many of the domestic dogs that we now have amongst us probably came out of Asia, which is really interesting. And that's some really interesting work and probably mirrored some of the agricultural developments in Asia and a whole interesting area of work that's being done in that. But if we think of it, the wolf, and, you know, I went to a presentation, we were hosting one at Washington, D.C. with a pet food company in the university years ago, and they invited a researcher from Yellowstone, and they had reintroduced the wolf into Yellowstone. And so they followed the wolves and looked at their behavior and how they took down prey. They looked at, you know, scatter their feces to look at what they had been eating and do all sorts of interesting work. What's really fascinating is that wolves and presumably dogs by extension will basically as a pack go and take down a very large predator. And they'll obviously get more food in that kill if they're successful than they can really eat in one sitting. So they will sit there and eat and gorge themselves, as you put it. And the researcher called it afterwards that they had a meat coma. They have so much food that afterwards they're just, you know, lying there. And they'll sometimes bury it or put that kill and they'll come back to it later, days later. But they may not eat for 2 or 3 days after that. And so we compare that to, we believe, the cat coming from the desert, probably in North Africa, and it being a small rodent and possibly small avian predator. And if you think about how many calories is in a field mouse or in a small bird, it isn't enough to sustain a cat if they just were to kill it once every few days. And so they're preying on many, many individuals, mice, let's say, in a given night. And they are more nocturnal. They have a preference for nocturnal feeding as a side comment. Right. And it makes sense. That's when their prey would probably be most susceptible to their, you know, killing spree.
Right, right.
And so if we think about that, they're going to be, you called it grazing. Grazing to me implies herbivore. So I'll use the term that they're just going to eat a lot of frequent small meals throughout the day. And they're really less prone to gorge because that just wasn't what they did. You don't see cats grouping together in a pack deciding that they're going to take down a cow.
Right.
And so they never really had enough in a single meal. And they're probably, you know, solitary predators. They're going to have a mouse, and a mouse might give them 25, 50 calories, something like that. And they probably need 250, 350. So they're going to have to kill 4 or 5 mice in a given evening. And so they spread out their meals. They're not going to happened upon a mouse family and have bloodbath and kill a whole mouse family. They're going to do one mouse here, one mouse there, and they're going to have to stalk them and do all that really cool predatory behavior that we try to mimic in their houses, and you can see them stalk things, and it's really neat behavior, right?
Yeah.
So to your point, they don't gorge as much. But in reality, the energy density of some foods, and especially dry foods, is very high, especially as you look at going from, I'll call it, a lower cost to a more ultra premium food.
Okay.
There's no definition of that, but in a single cup, you could go from anywhere in the low 200 calories per cup, or for, if we have international folks, that's 237 milliliters per 8 fluid ounce cup, to all the way up to 600 calories per cup. And I don't know exactly how much of a mouse would, if I was to push it into a cup, but I bet I could get a couple mice into a cup. You're never going to get two mice to be 300 calories per cup. And so in the same volume, you theoretically, if we're just doing some rough numbers and math, you could get six times the calories in a single meal. And if you go to dry food. And so an interesting discussion is looking at dry food and its energy density, and how much in every bite compared to just a canned food you would get. And you look at the density of a canned food, it's significantly less because often there's a large amount of water, which doesn't provide any calories whatsoever. It provides volume, and then there's gelling agents, you know, and just the natural structure of meat, let's say, that, or fresh foods that has holds water itself. And so there's just a lot less calories in canned or wet food, and as a general rule, versus dry. I don't know exactly what role that plays, but it is an interesting discussion, especially as we talk about what has changed over the course of the last 50 years, because people would talk about their cats, you know, not being heavy years ago. Well, they probably were more outdoor. We know that more cats live indoors, which means that they're not preying, hopefully, on mice, because hopefully people aren't infested with mice, right? And so they don't have the energy expenditure of hunting and stalking, and then when they are successful, having a pretty low yield, you know, amount of calories from all their efforts, they go and they go to the plate and there's a bowl food full of dry food that's just chock full of calories. But at the same time, what's happened is you see that canned food sales has really decreased. It's not as popular as it once was. And maybe that's has some role. It's interesting, if you talk to countries where canned food is still very popular, they don't seem to have the same amount of obesity. And I don't know what that is. Certainly there is different amounts on average of calories in dry food from carbohydrates versus canned food. And that's not always true, but often it is. And so is that playing a role? Is it the fact that there's more volume and the distension that you allude to that's playing a role, and they just feel full and they don't want to eat as much? And so therefore it leads, lends itself, as you transfer and you feed more often dry food than canned food. Is it the feeding strategy? It's work to open up a canned food. You have to open the can, you have to clean things. Whereas if you just put dry food, you can put several days worth of dry food out. If you use that same strategy with canned food, after a few hours, it becomes desiccated or it dries out and its palatability becomes very poor and the animal may not eat it. And so some debate is, well, maybe if you overfeed canned food, it's self-limiting, not only because they just can't eat as much because they fill up on it and all that water and it's not that much calories, but if you just let it sit there after a few hours, they're not going to want to eat it anyway until you open up a fresh can. And so it's inherently self-limiting. There's an increased cost of canned food per unit of calorie on average. So it's easier and cheaper to put out dry food and you don't worry about it. Whereas if you're cognizant of the fact that this is a dollar a can or two or three or four, whatever the net price is per can, you think about that more every time you pop that can open, you go ka-ching. Versus a dry food, it's a big bag, it's a little bit less, you know, you think, oh, there's a lot in here, and you just kind of freely feed it. And so all these different strategies and decisions that we make probably have some role. We don't know probably what specific aspects, certainly areas of interest where you talk about, okay, is it the higher protein nature, the lower carb protein, you know, carb nature of the dry food? Is it the moisture? Is it the feeding strategies of trough feeding versus meal portion control with canned or wet food? all really excellent questions, and we can dive into. I'm wanting to be cognizant of our breaks.
We're going to just be wild and crazy and skip the third break because this is too interesting. The thing that this brings to mind for me, and I think that it's something that people might be interested in themselves because it comes from the human nutrition side, is are all calories equal? Now, there was a doctor who was greatly maligned in his lifetime and has been proven correct for human nutrition over and over and over in different variations of the Atkins diet. And his theory, which is greatly distorted and not understood by people, and it just turns out that my husband was a patient of his for 5 years, an actual sit in the office, have long conversations kind of patient. And he was one of those people, not my husband, but Dr. Atkins, that was really poo-pooed in his own lifetime by his colleagues, and yet people with all kinds of metabolic issues, from diabetes to hypertension to whatever their problems were, which wasn't my husband's problem, it was some other issue, they all saw incredible results by reducing their carbs to an incredibly low level, not forever and ever, but in the beginning. And then it was basically a high protein and fat diet. So having known that, and I don't know how many diets can you count, the South Beach diet, the Miami diet, the French diet, all these diets basically are some variation. Now, people and dogs and cats all have different digestive systems and all kinds of different things that go into their choices. But I can tell you that in 7 years of having Cat Chat on the air on Sirius XM, when I said very black and white, because I don't think you're going to probably change my black and white stripes, but we're going to add some gray stripes to me over the years of Pet Food Advisors. And I welcome them because I understand it's almost more palatable to hear a black, a white, and a gray stripe story than all black and white. But people did embrace the advice that I gave based on the research I'd done, which is that those carbs in a cat throw off their metabolism or what make them fat and cause all kinds of other health problems, whether it's diabetes, other things, let's just say, to not get too incorrect about it. Because, for example, urinary tract issues that at one point a lot of people thought may have been linked to carbs now turns out are linked to stress. And that's now being proven over and over and over by good cat researchers, all those, which is a separate issue from nutrition, as it turns out. So it seemed that when people went to an all-wet diet, and yes, it was more trouble, and the expense, I would say, and Dr. Elizabeth Hodgkins and others would say, the money you're spending now is money in the bank that you don't have to go to the vet for various medical problems. So you're actually sparing illness or not taking yourself down a path that may lead to a lot of vet visits and discomfort for the animal. Those people reported to a man and a woman that even the cats, that it was hard to get them off kitty crack because the cats were addicted to the point of some of them meowing all day long, like crazy behavior, like a Labrador retriever, you know, at Thanksgiving all the time until they could finally be quote unquote weaned and gotten used to a more protein diet. Those cats slimmed down, some of them by half of their body weight. These were cats in the 20s of pounds, and their fur got shiny. They stopped shedding. They had been dull or matted and shedding a lot, and they became lively. This is reported by people. I didn't expect this at all. More affectionate, more energetic, like an improved personality, an improved energy level. They looked better. They felt better. Now, that is not even science. That's not even an N of one. That's not one person reporting it. It was lots of people, but obviously it's not scientific, right? No really good control group, except for all those people's animals previously were eating carbs. I guess in your world, which is, and you know, we're running out of time, so we're going to just leave this as a cliffhanger, guys, to next week. In your world, that's just reported by people. We can't go by that. Is that sort of where you fall in a long-winded anecdote like that?
I definitely think that there are cats that do very well on that strategy, and I think it's very interesting to figure out why. I would just say that I don't think every cat on dry food becomes obese and becomes diabetic. We have And I would add that not every overweight or obese cat becomes diabetic. So there's some things that are very interesting. I don't know that we have time to explore them by the end of this show, but what I will say about all of this is that what I find most fascinating is that the whole discussion about how best to feed a cat, ultimately, I don't think we can ignore that cats were a desert animal that is a carnivore that was getting most of its moisture from its diet. And what are the consequences when you change that? And that's a good cliffhanger for me.
I love that. That's a great cliffhanger for me too, because that is the question that often, or the kind of rationale that I have used and taken from others who used it. But as you point out, in the end of the day, there may be some things we're presuming or assuming that we have to think about twice. I always use the analogy about the cat that could eat dry food and is 22 years old and seems fine. Yeah, I had a grandfather who was 88, smoked a pack of cigarettes a day, drank half a bottle of vodka, never ate vegetables or fruit, and didn't exercise. There are individuals who can have like dietary abuse and lifestyle bad choices and live and seem fine, but it doesn't mean that their choices were healthy and would work for everybody else.
Absolutely. Nor would I say the converse aspect, that necessarily what you do is the worst thing for the animal. So we'll probably talk more about this. I think
we're
both very passionate about it. It's a great topic.
Show. Thank you so much, Sean. You're going to go home and have a bottle of vodka yourself after this. Thank you all so much for listening. We can't wait to visit with you next week. Kiss your kitties, hug your pooches. The Pet Food Advisors will be back. Thanks so much.